Please be seated. The final argument this morning is in the matter of the Joseph Baumgart Trust for the appellants. We have Mr. Matthew Bach, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and for the appellees, we have Mr. Vince Roche and Mr. Justin Clark. I understand Mr. Roche will be presenting this morning.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Very well. Justice Wilbur has disqualified herself on this case, and we are very pleased to welcome back an old friend and colleague, Justice Richard Savers, who served on this court for many years. With that, Mr. Bach, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, Matt Bach with the Woods Fuller Law Firm on behalf of the appellants in this case, Virginia Binder, Evelyn Lang, the estate of Lewis Hone, and Jean and Gloria Luce. This case presents an opportunity for this court to further solidify South Dakota status as the number one trust jurisdiction in the United States. We can do that in a couple of ways. First, we can assure practitioners, grantors of trusts, and beneficiaries, including charities, individuals who don't live here, minors, and as in this case, elderly individuals, that trustees in this state are required to act in the utmost good faith and uphold the duty of loyalty in the strictest sense. And secondly, we can show that when a court is asked to supervise a trust, it will do so in accord with the legislative mandate, and if it fails to supervise a trust, as it did in this case, the beneficiaries will not be prejudiced or harmed by the trial court's failure to supervise. To meet those goals, we have to answer a couple of questions in this case. First, did the trustees breach their trust and the duty of loyalty? Second, should the trustees be removed because of their breaches? Third, is there a remedy to the trust and the beneficiaries because of the breaches? And finally, are trustees entitled to compensation when they continually breach their trust? With respect to the breaches, there are about three categories of breach. The first is a breach of the duty of loyalty. The second is the breach of the duty of good faith and to provide information to beneficiaries when requested and information to the court. And finally, there are other miscellaneous breaches in the codified laws and the common law that the trustees and the court below classified as nitpicking. With the breach of duty of loyalty, the circuit court held as a matter of law at the start of the trial that the holding in In re Stevenson did not apply in this case. And so this court gets to review that determination de novo, that is, whether the holding in Stevenson applies in this case. And Stevenson's important for a couple of reasons. It's not only a case regarding SDCL section 55-4-13, which prohibits trustees from entering into transactions with certain individuals, but also more broadly defines the duty of loyalty as requiring a trustee to act at all times in the best interest of the beneficiaries, and even more than that, to not allow the beneficiaries to reasonably believe that the trustees are not acting in the best interest of the trust beneficiaries. And we have two examples of the breach of the duty of loyalty in this case. The first comes from the trustee's own testimony at the September trial in this case, and this is in the appendix at page 190. Mr. Borman was asked with respect to his duties in this case to whom he had a duty, and he responded all parties. And when pressed on that issue and asked if he had a duty to the trust farm tenants, he responded yes. That's a violation of the duty of loyalty because his sole conduct has to at all times be for the benefit of the beneficiaries.
But does that really mean anything in this case? It seemed to me that he just was trying to be fair to all parties, including, you know, the bank's customers, including prior tenants and so forth.
It does mean something in this case, Your Honor, because a trustee's sole duty is to the beneficiaries. You can be fair, but you always have to be acting with the beneficiary's best interest in mind. And the second breach of the duty of loyalty comes in the form of the Schmidt lease transaction. And that's where it really becomes apparent that it wasn't just trying to treat parties fair, but his personal interest in the transaction with Mr. Schmidt clouded his judgment with respect to the beneficiaries. And so that's why it's important in this case that he understood that he had a duty solely to the beneficiaries, because the beneficiaries could reasonably believe that he entered into those transactions thinking of not only the trust tenants and maybe about the beneficiaries.
Isn't it to the benefit of the beneficiaries to have a long-term stable renter?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And in this case, there were many long-term stable renters, and the primary asset being trust farm ground and a trust that we don't know where it's going to end, it's very important that we have stable rental relationships. If we examine how Mr. Schmidt came to be one of those long-term renters, it shows a breach of the duty of loyalty. First of all, there was a long-term renter, Jim Thuringer, that had leased the ground for many years. At the time, the summer of when Bob Borman's son married Lauren Schmidt's daughter, the Bormans sent a letter to Thuringer, a long-term tenant, and said, your services are no longer needed, you're terminated. That next crop year, Mr. Schmidt, the grandpa of Mr. Borman's granddaughter, leased 160 acres of trust property. Later on, he ended up leasing a total of 320 of the trust's 920 acres. And for all periods relevant to this case, 2009 through the present, he has leased that property at a discount to all other trust tenants. So the mere—
Is there any evidence in the record that Thuringer paid a higher rent and that the trustees dropped it for Schmidt?
No, Your Honor, and the reason is because at the time that Thuringer was renting, they were on a crop share basis. It wasn't until 2007, after the time that Mr. Schmidt had 320 of the acres, that they moved to a cash rent basis. So when they were on a cash rent basis, Mr. Schmidt always leased at a lower rate than any of the other tenants. And so it's that relationship between Mr. Schmidt and Mr. Bob Borman that breaches the duty of loyalty.
Didn't the trial court, though, have to look at the relationship? And just because there's a difference in rent isn't necessarily problematic if there's a difference in the value of the property as far as soil types and so forth for rent purposes. Isn't that a factual issue that the trial court had to weigh?
Your Honor, yes, if the duty of loyalty required looking into the transaction, but the duty of loyalty stops at the transaction and at the appearance that the transaction was improper. And one of the rationales offered for that strict adherence to the duty of loyalty is what happened in this case. Later on, you can come up with some rationale or some justification that might show, well, he didn't really get a discount because, you know, the soil was substandard, or he didn't really get a discount because, you know, his crop yields weren't as high. That type of after-the-fact rationalization is exactly why we have to stop at the transaction itself and the personal interest and the relationship that Mr. Schmidt had with Mr. Borman. And it doesn't stop at a bloodline, and it doesn't stop at the altar. And the Uniform Trust Code states that. We can even look at friendly relationships as violating the duty of loyalty. So there's no bright line at where that relationship ends. It's at the transaction. Now, if we look at that justification, if we look at those factual findings, there are a couple of problems with how the trial court handled that. First, there is no real evidence from 2009 through 2013 that the trustees looked at any objective data. Their after-the-fact rationalization said they looked at 2003 to 2006 data on how they determined the rents. They don't have any crop production information to know that Mr. Smith's ground performed more poorly than any of the other ground after 2006. And in fact, they call it cherry picking, the trustees do, but you could look at any given year, and particularly the first year that Mr. Schmidt had the Douglas County ground, he outperformed everybody. So in any given year.
This is Douglas County. This is a very rural area. Under the standard I hear you advocating today, I assume probably the only person in town that would be interested in doing this trustee on a local basis would be the banker. Aren't you setting the standard so high that you won't be able to get a local trustee in a rural area? Who are you going to get?
We can get a banker, Your Honor, but that banker has to be held to the same standard as any other corporate trustee in Sioux Falls, any other corporate trustee in Pierre, any other corporate trustee.
Does a corporate trustee in Sioux Falls know the
production capabilities of this land?
Oftentimes, corporate trustees hire farm managers. It's just one of the things that a trustee would have authority to do. And in this case, the trustees did not hire a farm manager. They simply claimed that they looked at 4 years of production experience, but they haven't done anything since, and so we really don't know. And this is not marginal ground. All of the ground is rated between 0.796 and 0.87. This is above average ground. And if you look at the parcels, each parcel, as compared, Mr. Schmidt's parcels perform just as well. But again, we don't have to do that. And the rationale for not doing that is because you can always make up a justification for what you did after the fact. So Mr. Borman admitted he thought he had a duty to the tenants, and he entered into this transaction with Mr. Schmidt. That's a breach of the duty of loyalty. With respect to information in this case, the trustees failed to provide the court information as required in their annual accountings. They didn't provide copies of the transaction documents, the leases, and they didn't notify the court of any of the relationships or what the per parcel rent was, and they didn't provide the court with the total acreage owned by the trust. They only listed 680 of 920 acres on the accounting. So the court didn't have all the information it needed to do its job. That's a breach of the duty of good faith, and it's a breach of the duty to provide information to the court. In addition, SDCL 55-2-13 requires that upon reasonable request, a trustee provide information to a beneficiary. And the court actually decided this issue on summary judgment in June when it dismissed the petitioner's demand for information claim, but it also made clearly erroneous findings. So under either standard, the court erred on this breach with respect to the duty to provide information. In early 2013, Mr. Loos, after a conversation with an uncle of his regarding how many acres the trust owned, asked the trustee's attorney, how many acres does the trust own? He got no response. So he asked again, and in addition to that question, he asked, what is the rent per parcel? The trustee's lawyer responded, approximately 900 acres. Didn't provide the rent per parcel. The trustee and Mr. Loos had a conversation prior to the 2012 accounting hearing, which was held in 2013. Didn't provide any copies of the leases, did not provide the rent per parcel, and Mr. Loos informed him, hey, you know, I can't make the accounting hearing in January for 2012. Trustees went about their business. They didn't notify the court that there were questions with respect to how much the trust owned or questions with respect to how the rent was going. Not having heard anything, Mr. Loos then in August followed up with the trustees, and he emailed and he called asking for information with respect to the trust, because based on the 900 acres and divided by the gross rent, he thought maybe those rents are a little below market based on conversations he had had with local farmers and reading some of the published data on farm outputs. The trustee refused to provide any information other than what those gross rents were, and he certainly would not provide copies of the leases. Thereafter, Mr. Loos engaged the Woods Fuller Law Firm. Our law firm sent a letter to the trustee's lawyer asking for copies of the leases. No response. Finally, a few days later, the 2014 leases are provided, but we had asked for the 2007 through 2013 leases, in addition to the 2014 leases. The 2014 leases were provided presumably to show that the rent was $165 or $150, if you believe the Schmidt discount, and $135 on his Douglas County parcel, as those were fair market value rents. But when we later got the leases in January for 2007 to 2013, we noted that rent had been increased 50% or more in 1 year just based on the questions regarding what the rent per parcel was. And the increase wasn't actually that great, because for the first time, the trustees stopped leasing 160 acres at $105 an acre, so that one quarter rented for the same amount as another quarter, and they started leasing based on the crop acres. And the fact is, they didn't provide the 2007 leases and through 2013 leases until January, 2012 leases until January, and then they didn't provide the 2013 leases until after the petition, after discovery, and after two summary judgment motions with respect to those leases. So they just persistently failed to provide copies of the leases. And the reason UTC 706 says that this is a particularly egregious breach is that failures to provide information disallows the beneficiaries from protecting their interests. And so those failures to provide...
Was all that information available in the court file from year to year to year?
The leases were not available, Your Honor, because they were not included with the accountings and they were not included with the vouchers. And so, no, the leases were not available. But in any event, that's what the trial court stated, and that's clearly erroneous because the legal standard is provide the information to the beneficiaries upon reasonable request, not send 82 to 95-year-old beneficiaries to Olivet to dig through the court file that, as the circuit court mentioned, is voluminous. I mean, that's just not the standard. And so they failed to provide any information. And then there were a number of other breaches that the court didn't find to be breaches. One, they deposit funds in a bank account that they own. The codified law and common law doesn't allow that. If you're a corporate trustee, you can deposit trust funds in your own account. If you're an individual, you cannot deposit funds in a bank that you own. It's just a violation of the law. In addition, they didn't provide any notice to the contingent remainder beneficiaries of any of the accountings. They haven't done anything with respect to determining the production since 2006. When they went to Crop Acres, they continued the breach with respect to Lauren Schmidt, and this is particularly egregious. If you look at Petitioner's Exhibit 6 from the trial, you can see that where they had leased 160 acres at $87.50, they crossed that off, and then they put two new numbers on top of that Exhibit 6. They put 142 acres for one parcel and 147 acres for another parcel. And then they did rent at $135 and $150. Where did they get that $147 and $142? They looked at either the non-highly erodible USDA report, which said how many non-highly erodible acres there were, or they looked at a soil summary report. Well, with respect to Mr. Schmidt, and you have to go to Trustees Exhibit 5 for this, with respect to Mr. Schmidt on his Douglas County parcel, the non-highly erodible report said 153. The soil summary said 160. The non-highly erodible report, they crossed out 153 and put in 147. He got a six-acre discount to this day for no reason, no justification. They continue to breach their trust to these beneficiaries. So then we have to ask the question, did the court abuse its discretion in not removing the trustees because of their breaches? And if you find that there were breaches, there was an abuse of discretion because an abuse of discretion includes a incorrect legal conclusion guiding your decision. And so if all of those actions were breaches, it's an abuse of discretion to not remove those trustees under SDCL 55-3-20 and Section 20.1, which allows removal for a serious breach of trust or a continuous failure to effectively administer a trust. So if you believe those were breaches, then you can also find there was abuse of discretion on the failure to remove. And because he didn't find any breaches, he didn't remove the trial court judge. The next issue is with respect to the remedy to the trust if you believe that these were breaches. And there are two ways. We're not only dealing with 2013, but we're also dealing with 2009 through 2012. And there's two ways to get through 2009 and 2012. The first is to look at the court's failure to properly supervise the trust. The court signed orders that stated he'd reviewed documents that weren't filed at the time he signed the order. And if we look at the process itself, up until the trial in September 2014, the trustees had never been in court. The trustee's lawyer had never been in court. They simply sent an ex parte letter to the judge saying, hey, judge, nobody's going to show up. Do you mind signing this order? The order referenced vouchers that were never filed on anybody or never served on anybody and weren't filed until after the time that the court considered the matter. In any event, didn't contain the transaction documents, the leases. Signed the order. Order was never served. None of the parties had any opportunity to challenge that accounting process. The judge looked at it through the wrong lens. In April, on page 8 of the transcript from the April hearing, the judge said, well, I find it incumbent upon the beneficiaries to come forward with objections. That's not the standard. SDCL 21-22, sections 22 and 23 provide that a judge, irrespective of whether any objections are made, must independently examine the record and determine that all transactions were in the best interest of the trust. How did he determine that all transactions were best interest of the trust if he didn't have the leases? And if all of the information wasn't provided
Now, the vouchers contain a significant amount of material, 1099s, tax records, receipts from grain elevators during the cash rent years, bank statements, and so on. Do we know from the record whether or not those vouchers were at the courthouse and available to the trial court judge at the time that he reviewed the proposed orders?
The vouchers for 2009, 2010, and 2011 were not filed at the time the court entered its order. In 2012, they appeared to be filed at the same day.
So filed meaning stamped. Do you know whether or not they were available in the clerk's office?
There was certainly no evidence, Your Honor, but the trial judge tried to put it on the clerk, which I have more faith in our clerks that when they get something in, they stamp it on that day, that it wouldn't be 8 months later that they finally get around to stamping something.
So your view is that the vouchers were provided later?
Yes, and that's... The only evidence in the record is that they were filed later, and the trustees couldn't verify when they were filed.
And what years?
9, 10, and 11. There was 1 year during this period where the vouchers would have been filed on the same day as the accounting report.
Thank you.
Okay. And so, you know, all of these failures warrant removal and a remedy to the beneficiaries. I'm out of time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bach. Mr. Roche, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Vince Roach from the Davenport Evans firm on behalf of the trustees, Bob and Paul Borman. The first point that I'd like to bring into focus for the court is that this is an appeal of a trust administration proceeding. It's not an appeal from a civil lawsuit. This court has said on multiple occasions that the task of this court and the trial court is to make sure that the intentions and wishes of the settlor are honored. That most recently was stated in the Luke versus Stevenson case. So the fundamental question that this court asks is whether Judge Ng's rulings honored Joseph Baumgart's wishes when he declined to remove the expressly named trustees after decades of service. And when you consider that question, it's important to focus on what the record reflects. Joseph was a bachelor who had a very close relationship with his banker, Vern Borman, who is the current trustee's father. He didn't trust many people, but he trusted Vern Borman. He visited the bank multiple times a week to visit with Vern, and when it came time to set up his trust, he asked Vern and his lawyer at the time, Henry Horstman, to be the trustees of the trust. And when he wrote the trust instrument, he set it up to say that the trustees shall be free from any error in judgment, and the standard of liability in the trust instrument that he set was a willful default. And of course, he set it up that way because he didn't want the decisions of his hand-selected trustees to be second-guessed at every turn. And there's also evidence in the record, this is pages 22 through 25 of the trial transcript, that Joseph called Bob Borman into Bob's father's office and specifically asked him if he would serve as trustee, because obviously Joseph recognized that the initial trustees were likely to decease before the trust terminated. So Bob and Paul agreed to serve as the trustees, and they continue to do so to this day. The evidence in the record is not that they do it because they need the couple thousand dollars a year of the trustee's fee to which they're entitled. It's because they made a promise to one of the customers of their family's bank. So as the court considers the parties' respective arguments, I would suggest that it boils down to a simple question. If Joe Baumgart were still alive today, would he want his hand-picked trustees removed in the twilight years of this trust? Or would he want them replaced by some corporate trustee from Sioux Falls as selected by the beneficiaries? Judge Ng certainly didn't think that it would be consistent with Joseph's intent after he heard the totality of the evidence and had the chance to judge the credibility of the witnesses. And I think this court can fairly easily conclude that Judge Ng did not abuse his discretion when he found that the trustees did not either commit a serious breach of the trust or persistently fail to administer the trust effectively. And those are the standards that the beneficiaries need to meet under SDCL 55-3-20.1 in order to succeed in removing the trustees. And of course, the abuse of discretion standard is the most deferential standard of review applied by this court. I'll try to respond to the three categories, if you will, of breaches, alleged breaches identified by Mr. Bach. I want to start with the alleged failure to provide information. Mr. Bach said that those demands were based on SDCL 55-2-13, but if you look at the statute, it says that that only applies to trusts created after 2002. And of course, this trust was created in the mid-70s, so it long pre-existed the statute. But more importantly, the record reflects that the trustees were open with Mr. Luce, and the suggestion that they failed to keep Mr. Luce reasonably informed is simply inconsistent with the record. And the timeline established by the record is this. In 2006, several of the beneficiaries came to the trustees and said, hey, we'd like to change from sharecropping to cash rent because the income is too inconsistent and unpredictable with a sharecropping relationship. At that point, the trustees could have said, sorry, this is our realm. You don't have any right to participate in how the land is leased out. But instead, they sat down with them and took their input into consideration, and they did change the leases to cash rent, beginning in 2007. The next contact was in January of 2013, where Mr. Bach conceded there was a phone call between Bob Borman and Mr. Luce to discuss the trust business. And then again, there's a phone call in August of 2013, on Wednesday, August 28th. And on Friday, August 30th, Mr. Luce writes and thanks Bob for providing information on the trust and helping him understand the history of the land. And I'm quoting from page 9 of Trial Exhibit 15. This is what Mr. Luce writes. Bob, thanks for the phone call on Wednesday regarding the land rental on the Baumgart estate. I appreciate your giving me insight on the history of the land and what is currently transpiring on the leases for the land. And then Mr. Luce concludes his email by asking if they can meet again. Bob Borman writes back and he says, quote, I look forward to meeting with you in the future, end quote. Again, that's Trial Exhibit 15. That meeting didn't take place, however, because a mere 5 days later, the trustees get a letter from the Woods Fuller law firm demanding that they resign as trustees. So at the end of the day, the idea that Mr. Luce didn't have any choice but to hire lawyers to help him get information and to demand that the trustees resign is simply belied by the record. The last thing that the trustees knew, they were going to have a meeting with Mr. Luce in Parkston to talk about the trust. But instead of that meeting, they received a letter from the Woods Fuller firm demanding that they resign. So we said this at the trial, and we say it again here, it's not too much of a stretch to conclude that what this case is about is Mr. Luce's desire to strong-arm these trustees out of the trust and so he can control it. And the idea of an independent trustee, I mean, the trial transcript at page 179 reflects that Mr. Luce wanted to have one of his friends at a bank in Sioux Falls appointed the new trustee. And, of course, that gives him de facto control over the trust. Here again, this is something we're judging, had a chance to gauge the credibility of the witnesses, and we think that he followed this court's holding in the In Re Betty Lures case that, quote, this court will not sanction the creation of hostility by a beneficiary in order to effectuate the removal of a trustee, end quote. And we respectfully submit that that's what we have here. The next point raised by Mr. Bach is the idea that the rental rates to Mr. Schmidt were somehow unfair. But before we get into the details on that, I would again call the court's attention to Trial Exhibit 15, which contains this letter from the Woods Fuller firm demanding that the trustees resign. That letter included an offer to waive any and all liabilities against the trustees if they would simply step down. And I would respectfully suggest that if the land had been leased for so far undervalued that it had caused significant harm to the trust, then the beneficiaries wouldn't have right out of the gate said, we'll waive any claims against you. So we think that the actions speak louder than words when we get to talking about whether these rental rates were or were not fair. Now, we pointed this out in our brief as far as this question of whether Lauren Schmidt is Bob Borman's relative. The statutes define who's a relative. It's SDCL 55-4-13, which says you can't lease or sell trust property to a relative. And then 55-4-1 lists the people who are considered relatives. And it's defined as spouse, ancestor, descendant, brother, or sister. And Lauren Schmidt and Bob Borman are neither of those things. So as this court has said innumerable times, it's not for the court to rewrite the statutory classes of persons that the legislature has put down.
So is your contention that that's a safe harbor, that if they aren't those named individuals, then the duty of loyalty doesn't apply?
No, Your Honor. You still have...
Isn't that very, very dangerous?
No, because you still have SDCL 55-2-2, which is the general duty of loyalty statute that says you cannot use trust property to benefit yourself. And there's no proof in the record, not even an allegation here, that either of the Bormans received any sort of kickback or improper benefit due to the lease to Mr. Schmidt. So my suggestion then is that the beneficiaries want to add categories to the list of relatives defined in 55-4-1 and go beyond what the legislature actually wrote there. And I've read Stevenson multiple times in preparation for today, and I don't see anywhere where this court purported to expand the statutory definition of relative. But even if we were talking about expanding upon the legislative definition of what relative means, you've got two types of relatives, of course. You have relatives by blood or consanguinity, and you have relatives by affinity, which are your spouse's blood relatives. But here again, Mr. Schmidt and Mr. Borman are not related in either of those ways. So my reading of Stevenson is that the court was more focused on whether the trust instrument itself allowed a self-dealing transaction that otherwise would be prohibited by 55-2-2 and was not focused expressly on the question of what is a relative. So the leases here, we suggest it's undisputed, do not violate either 55-4-13 because the land is not leased to a relative, nor do they violate 55-2-2 because there's, again, no proof that either of the trustees received any sort of improper benefit from the leases in question. And again, it would be a very difficult standard for trustees and courts to apply if this court was to say, despite the fact that the legislature has specifically listed what is a prohibited lease transaction and who you can't lease property to, if this court were to say it's broader than that and it includes friends, acquaintances.
But isn't it broader than that in that a trustee could still breach his duty even if it isn't a relative, if it's not in the best interest of the trust?
That's true, but that's if he's violating 55-2-2.
So you're saying the only time is if he is personally benefiting or if it's a named relative, that he has no other duty?
When we're talking about the specifically identified people that the legislature has said you can't deal with trust property to, that's correct. Would it be a breach of duty if the trustee leased it to his friend and then got a kickback? Absolutely, under 55-2-2. But that's not what the record reflects here, Your Honor.
What about chop your sentence if he just leased it to a friend and it wasn't in the best interest of the trust?
Well, if he breaches his fiduciary duty, then if he's liable under the standard set forth in the trust instrument, then that could give rise to a cause of action for damages. But again, that's not the proof that we have here. I mean, Judge Ng said that
cause of damages, could it also be cause for removing the trustee?
The question of whether a trustee should be removed is a totality of the circumstances test. And that is certainly something that the court could consider when it considered all of the other factors, including that these particular trustees were expressly named in the trust instrument. But if we look back at the record, and Judge Ng's lengthy and we thought well-reasoned opinion that he gave on the record, he said, look, you can cherry-pick any numbers and make a certain year make it look terrible or look like a great deal for the trust. But Judge Ng correctly found that these trustees did it the right way. Again, when the beneficiaries came and said, we want to change to cash rent leases, we didn't pull the numbers out of the air. We sat down, not by ourselves, but with a CPA, as reflected on page 36 of the trial transcript, and we looked at the prior 4 years production records for the land. And that's exactly what the federal government looks to when it's figuring out your benchmarks for federal crop insurance. And we used those numbers to come up with what we thought were the fair rental rates. And I would submit that the purest way that you can use to figure out whether the leases were fair is look at how much rent each tenant paid per bushel of corn harvested. And to get that figure, I would cite the court to the petitioner's own average rental rate chart on page 9 of their opening brief and compare it against the average yield figures in the table on page 5 of their reply brief. And if you do that, remember we're talking about five groups of renters. There's four Bialis families, and then there's Lauren Schmidt. And if you line those figures up on a continuum, you have a Bialis, Mr. Schmidt right in the middle, a Bialis, and a Bialis. So it's impossible to say that Mr. Schmidt got some sweetheart deal when the actual figures reflect that he's right in the middle when you actually look at averages over a period of 4 years and then the average rental rates that are charged.
To go back for a minute as to whether or not the trustees benefited themselves, wouldn't you look at how much work they had to put into it? Maybe they wanted basically a long-term tenant, even though it's a one-year lease, somebody who wouldn't give them any problems. There's a benefit to the bank of which they own that. So there's a lot of other factors that the trustees could favor themselves or benefit, couldn't they?
Well, the trustees are statutorily entitled to a trustee's fee, and the record reflects...
I'm not talking about their fees. I'm talking about the other elements of it. If they don't have to do any work for those fees, if they can just leave the leases going year after year after year.
That's not what the record reflected, though, Justice Sabres. The record reflected that they visited the land on multiple occasions, communicated with the beneficiaries about projects to improve the value of the land once it's finally sold at the end of the trust. And so they did earn their trustee's fee, and in fact, the record also reflected that it was about 40% less than what the prevailing market rate was. So they weren't doing this solely to earn a couple thousand dollars worth of trustees' fees over the years. I also want to touch briefly, and this will answer the second part of your question, I believe, Justice Sabre, this idea that the renters are business associates under SDCL 55-4-13 because the tenants are also bank customers. I would like to spend a little bit of time on that because it showed up for the first time in the beneficiary's reply brief, and so we didn't get a chance to brief it. First of all, there's no citation offered for the notion that any customer of a trustee is also a quote-unquote business associate. And I think you hit the nail on the head, Justice Gilbertson, when you said, look, if you call everyone in a small town a business associate, then you're going to wipe out the whole pool of potential renters. But beyond that, these renters were customers of the bank when Joseph Baumgart set this trust up. He knew that these Bialis family members were customers of the bank, and he told Bob Baumgart that he expected them to continue to rent it. And under the Lewis case, this court said when the settlor appoints a trustee fully knowing that there is a potential conflict of interest, you can't later look to that alleged conflict of interest and attempt to use it to remove the trustee. To conclude my remarks, I'd like to respond briefly, if I may, to Mr. Bach's suggestion that if the court doesn't reverse Judge Ng, that it's chasing trust business out of South Dakota. I'd, again, tie this all back to the Betty Lurz case, where this court promised people who would set up trusts in this state that if they specifically name a trustee in the trust instrument, this court is not going to sanction removal of that trustee unless the trust corpus is in danger of dissipation. And there's no proof in the record that the trust corpus is in danger of dissipation whatsoever. And that's not just South Dakota law. We cited case law from all around the country in our brief. And so we'd respectfully suggest that if the court fails to affirm Judge Ng, it's sending a bad message to people that their decision and handpicked trustee might be removed from that role many years down the road based on some minor disagreements. And even more fundamentally, we'd be overriding the plain and unambiguous intent of Joe Baumgart when he named Bob and Paul Borman as trustees in the trust instrument.
Thank you, Mr. Roche. Mr. Bach, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal, sir.
The rationale for the strict standard of the duty of loyalty is this exact situation. Oftentimes, trustees may be friends with the trust grantor, but that's exactly why we have to hold those trustees to a high standard so they don't take advantage of that friendship. Once you become a trustee, you're no longer friends. You have a higher duty not only to your grantor, but to the beneficiaries that that grantor intended to benefit. And Justice Gilbertson, In re Estate of Stevenson's answers your question about how do we handle trustees within small towns, and there's a simple answer. If you want these types of transactions to be authorized, you put it in your trust instrument. And that's what In re Estate of Stevenson says. If you want to authorize self-dealing, if you want to be able to rent to your granddaughter's grandpa, put it in the trust instrument. You're going to open up the whole town to be able to be your trustee. In this case, that wasn't authorized in this trust. And so, unfortunately, we do have to hold the Bormans to that utmost and high standard. With respect to...
Excuse me, counsel, did you suggest, when you mentioned the fact that Thuringer had received a letter from the trustees, that the trustees had fired him? It appears there's evidence in the record that he was done ending his farming operation.
That was the testimony, that he was done ending his farm operation, but the letter was not in the tone of having a conversation with Mr. Thuringer, and you can look at Petitioner's Exhibit 20 from the trial. It's a very formal letter that says, hey, thanks for renting in the past. Your lease is terminated. It doesn't say, thanks for letting us know you're winding down your operation. Appreciate that in advance. You know, don't worry about it. We'll get a new tenant. It says, don't do any fall work. You're terminated. So the tone was one of termination, and the timing coincides with the marriage between Schmidt's son and Mr. Borman's son and Mr. Schmidt's daughter. And so, you know, yes, there was a letter terminating. Was he winding down? We don't know from the tone of that letter, and it certainly looks like he was terminated rather than he notified them.
Their position was, though, that the termination letter must be in writing rather than just an oral thing. Otherwise, he could have stayed on the farm and farmed one more time, couldn't he?
Yes, Your Honor, that's absolutely correct. But the tone of the letter was, don't do any fall work, you're terminated.
Isn't that just a form letter, though?
It could have been, and I guess we don't necessarily know. But if we put that together with all the facts that at the time the children were getting married and the only tenant that that land is offered to happens to be the grandfather of one of the trustees' granddaughters, certainly can lead a beneficiary to reasonably believe that that transaction was not in the best interest of the trust.
But the banker testified that they quit farming and they told him so, and that's why he sent the letter. That's the only evidence in it besides the letter, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, that he quit farming. But when did he quit farming? We don't have any communication from Mr. Thuringer. But, yes, the banker did testify that they were notified by Mr. Thuringer. And certainly it could be a coincidence. But the duty of loyalty requires that we look at it from the beneficiary standpoint. And could they reasonably suspect that this transaction was not in their best interest? And, in addition, the testimony is we only offered it to one tenant. And it happens to be the one that Mr. Borman has a personal interest with. They didn't open it up to the Belos family, who said Mr. Baumgart really trusted. I mean, they went directly to Lauren Schmidt and offered him the land. Why not the Belosses? They were renting all the land. Mr. Baumgart knew them. They had done a fine job. So you're right. The question's unanswered in the record itself. But if we look at all the facts, you could at least reasonably suspect that that transaction is not in the best interest, and compound that with the Schmidt discount that exists to this day. With respect to the hostilities that the trustees allege Mr. Loos created, that's just simply not the case. In those conversations, he asked for simple information. What is the rent per parcel? Where are the leases? Now, Mr. Borman can claim that, oh, we were going to talk about the leases, or, oh, I provided some context. But if we look at his testimony, and this is in the appendix at page 206, he was asked, did Mr. Loos ask for the leases? I don't know, but I assume that to be so, is what he stated. And then when asked, did he provide any information regarding the leases prior to the lawsuit? We didn't believe that to be pertinent because he was a contingent beneficiary, not an income beneficiary. This was not a hostility created by Mr. Loos. Mr. Borman refused to provide information with respect to the leases or the rent per parcel. That follow-up conversation, he told Mr. Loos, I'm only going to provide the gross rent. That's why the letter from Woods Fuller saying, hey, can you provide the leases? And by the way, we'd like a fair shake here. It wasn't a hostility. It was, we're not getting along. You're not providing information. Can we get an independent third-party trustee? We're not asking that additional categories be added to SDCL 55-4-13. And In re Estate of Stevenson doesn't create additional categories. It looks exactly at that duty of loyalty. And the trustee's husband's cousin wasn't analyzed under 55-4-13, wasn't analyzed under any table of consanguinity or affinity. It was simply determined that a lease to someone with whom the trustee may have a personal interest that could leave somebody to believe that the transaction was not in the beneficiary's best interest is void. That was the trustee's husband's cousin, how that was analyzed. But truly, it's more a case about whether or not self-dealing language was really in the trust, but they certainly didn't expand the class. They just went directly to the duty of loyalty and determined that a trustee's husband's cousin lease violated that duty of loyalty because there could have been a presumption that that transaction was not in the best interest of the beneficiaries. And Section 170 of the restatement, which is cited in Stevenson, comment E, is particularly appropriate to the question of what about friendly relationships, and what about the benefit to the trustee? Well, if the trustee leased the land to a friend, this is in comment E, for less than he could have gotten from another tenant, that's a violation of the duty of loyalty. And certainly there's a question to be asked as to whether or not the Schmidt got a discount. I mean, it's just there. There's that question. So that's a violation of the duty of loyalty. It's within the restatement, Section 170. So there's ample authority to find that that transaction violated the breach of the duty of loyalty. And more importantly, under Uniform Trust Code 706, it says these failures to provide information, these failures to communicate with the court are particularly egregious and really do warrant removal because they allow trustees for many years to hide information from beneficiaries. The beneficiaries are not able to protect their interests when they're not provided information by the trustees. And the trustees failed to do that once when providing information to the court, and secondly, when directly asked for that information. And for that reason, they should be removed and the trust should be made whole. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brett. Court will be in recess.